don't have to like everything we say. You don't have to listen to us.
Diego de Yankee, Ali America.
Call cannot be completed as that.
Kenmore, I just wanted to know if you
Well, if you ever wondered how I do it or how I used to do it when I was working, how we, since we talked about it with reading the news and looking at sources, how do we do it on a professional side? How do we evaluate our sources of information? How do we evaluate the information they're giving us? What are some techniques and things we use to check that information, check that source while we're talking to them, and some of the bigger things we might do before, during, and after effects that not everybody has access to? So from here, we'll get a little trivia and learn some stuff that we do to verify our information and our sources, but we'll also take a look at some things you can do, if you want to kind of double check your source of information, your source, as well as the information. So we're going to use some questioning techniques and look at some background check stuff you can do right here on Gray Man, Hiding in Plain Sight. So this ought to be fun. In fact, the first part of this, you're going to get a little look at what it's like to be me reading emails. So when I got this, it was a little bit suspect, but it started off with, "Hello, I hope you're doing well. I've been a massive fan of your show for a while now and so glad that you chose to interact with your audience." So the way this is phrased is so funny. It's long enough. It's like a full written paragraph that I chose to read it. But that alone is like first half. Sounds like the first 50%. Most of the bullshit marketing ones where people like randomly send you stuff that's written in a way to just target every podcaster because they want you to pay them money to use their editing tools or something like that. So then it goes on and says, "Some of the episodes you've published have been found practical use in my life. It is rare that I find myself making time to listen to podcasts. However, I find myself always willing to sit down and listen to a Gray Man Concepts episode." So even further, like, that was clearing it up pretty good. And I was like, all right, this is real. But then when he actually wrote the whole thing in there, it sounded like nobody does that except for these guys that do these scams. But it's not a scam. That's the first half of the email. This is a legit email from someone we're going to call Sir Lancelot. And it says, "As time has gone by, I've come up with a question that I hope you can answer." So this is a good question, what we're doing the show on. I'm going to focus on a couple of human intelligence techniques, but we're going to talk through some other stuff too. But here's it goes. He says, "How does one properly vet the information of a voluntary human sources, whether it's a walk-in source or controlled asset? It always seems incredibly difficult to verify both the information provided by these individuals and the individuals themselves. Do you have any tips, tricks, or guidance on how to properly vet these sources when normal vetting options aren't always available? Thank you so much for your time." So how this is written, I'm just going to make some assumptions here. Well, these are presumptions, logical conclusions based on the writing. This individual works in the field, and they either do intel analysis or they are counterintelligence or human intelligence, because the way that question's written could be from any three of them. So probably human or CI. So we're looking for these voluntary sources first. While the way in which we discuss, I'll say discuss, because you probably work in this field, we know there's certain words that are common to use, but mean things have legal applications. So like if I was to say, the way you approach this, approaches are an actual technique used in interrogation. And if you're a legit trained interrogator, you know it's illegal to use those outside of the confines of when you're doing an actual lawful interrogation. If you're doing it any otherwise, you're committing a crime, except for maybe like doing, say, instructing like I do on the show. So I don't want to say that. So the way in which we talk to these people and deal with these interactions have a lot of effect on the things that happen in the future. But it's important to note that while our attitudes or our methods or the things, the techniques we use might differ from person to person, which may lean heavily on whether or not they're volunteer or, say, detained against their will, there isn't a whole lot of difference in how we handle the situation just because they're volunteer. There's the way in which we will have the conversation will, of course, be different. We want to be very careful about how we have these conversations. We want to treat them like a volunteer and not like a bad guy. Of course, we want to do that. But the techniques we're going to use work for everybody. It's no different than in an interrogation using approaches or the questioning techniques you're going to use. Is it working well at that time for that reason, for that person on that day, for, you know, whatever's going on? So we'll take a look at those. And we'll talk about, like you said, properly vet these sources. So these are people we're talking to. But we're also going to look at the information, because part of this is vetting the information, whether or not we're vetting the source. We have to do both. Some things we'll do both. Some will only do one or the other. Now, the way the person wrote this, some of the things we're looking at here is, my guess is, this is definitely a presumption, this is a strategic guess, but if they are in fact working in the field, they're low level. Now, they very well could be working in law enforcement too. This is very possible to be law enforcement. Most 95% of the law enforcement in the United States or Canada will have, or at least the United States, I don't know percentages of Canada, but easily 95% of law enforcement is going to be no different than low-level human guys in the intel field. So lowest level guys, you're talking like military. Okay, not just them, but mostly of them are going to be in military. Worst place to be when it comes to vetting, because you have the least amount of things available to you other than your own skills. And even when they are available, the people don't want to do it. You know, you're going up to the warrant officer and being like, hey, can you contact the agency in question? They're not going to do it, even if it's justified. It's just not going to happen. But at the higher levels, there's a certain amount of ninja magic that goes on. I mean, you got places like CIA and NSA got 40, 50,000 employees. You know, the FBI's got like 30,000, and there's, you know, another 200 or 300,000 people who work in the intel field. Now, while most of them aren't collectors or even analysts, they're doing other jobs. They're there as support assets of different types. So there's all kinds of things. Like, I mean, just think what computers can do now. Whatever you're listening to this on probably has some significant capabilities. So imagine what they have. Like, they could search anything out there publicly on the internet in any country. You know, not to mention they have connections to spies and agencies in other parts of the world. So if they've ever talked to this person, or if this person worked for, I mean, they've got people they'll get information from and whatever's out there, plus any dossier or amount of information that already exists on this person. Just like the information they provide, it might be, okay, so you told, like I always told the joke, guys were like, yeah, you know, Osama's over in Pakistan, pay me money. It was like, we know that. So there's all, just like there's cataloged information about data that we're collecting, there's cataloged information on the sources sometimes, or we build that. And we can find out all kinds of great stuff. That's at the pro levels. But when you're like Joe Bob Humic guy in an HCT in the military, you know, there's some extreme limitations. Instead of saying limitations, there's a whole bunch of shit that's just not available to you. You've got to deal with what your capabilities are as an individual. Now, the upside to this is just my opinion based on some experiences I've had. If you develop your skills well, you might be better off in that position, because there's some guys at the higher levels that sometimes they're kind of lazy about these conversations, because they're like, yeah, I got all these electronics and thousands of dudes over here going to check this stuff for me. And it's like, yeah, but if you do it at the source, it's a little better. It's like, you know, bottled water like we collected at the source. I mean, it sounds better, but it actually is better when we're dealing with people and information. So the biggest thing I'm going to focus on is repeat and control questions. I'm explaining to you what they are, and even if you know what they are, I'm going to help you do them better. This is a moneymaker right here, because you can't use, or lawfully can't use, approach techniques when you're dealing with walk-in sources, people like this. And depending on your situation and where you're at, you may only have a limited amount of time with them. You know, military guys that are on deployment, when this was happening for 20 years in the Middle East, they could be in some random outpost where dude shows up and talks to them, and they get all day if they want it. But there's other places where there's like a line at the door. There's a line at the base, and I want to talk to the CIA guy, you know, and ends up being an Army interrogator, a counterintelligence agent. And they're like, yeah, I know where bombs are, you know, or whatever. It's like, okay, it sounds good. Let's put him in the line, check him in. He goes through all his stuff. And then they bring him in, but you've got limited time. Like, this dude needs to sell you on his information in a matter of minutes, or you're about ready to kick him out of there, because you got people to get through. So we need to be able to identify very quickly, you know, whether or not this conversation's worth even having. So it depends on who you are and what situation you're in, how much time you have. So what we're looking at for repeat and control questions. Control questions, if you ask a law enforcement person, they're going to give you a correct definition of it that is also incorrect for us. Correct definition, one of them, is these questions they'll use similar to like on a lie detector, but they'll use in other situations where it's designed to throw you a little off balance and to get an emotional response in order to detect deception. The ways in which it's used with lie detection systems is one of the biggest failures of it. It's so poorly executed, it could be done a lot better. But that's not the technique we're using. We're using the other definition in the intel side, which is we're going to ask them about things we already know, right? So we're not into the lying stage yet. We're into the, I know this for sure, or this is the information I have, so I'm going to use it to challenge this guy. Okay, so we're using known information to challenge them. Okay, we will eventually use them to verify known or suspected information. So make sure, it's kind of up to you, but look at the information you have on a subject, whether or not it's known or suspected. So how do we do that? So looking at control questions. This guy comes in and he tells you he knows where something's going to happen, whatever you're talking to him about. I know this bad thing. Right. So based on your level of knowledge and available information at the time, we can approach some control questions about things we know to the situation. Now, maybe you're an expert on the bomb maker that he's talking about, and I'm just going to use that as an example, but maybe not. Maybe you just know a lot about the town he's coming from when he's talking about, and you don't know shit about the bomb makers yet. But we can use some of these control questions about things we know to get this conversation going, to kind of verify whether or not those questions and his answers have some consistency and whether or not they look good. You can then later, and this is an overview before we get more specific, you can then later set up time for him to come back and then take what you have that you're writing your report on, and then you can go do some more research on your own on that information to get a little more knowledgeable on it so you can ask better control questions next time. The other thing we're doing is repeat questions. Repeat questions, we're asking the same question again, okay? But we're not like you see in a movie when it's all crappy, when they literally say word for word the same thing, or they're like, well, did you don't do this today or whatever? And they're like, no. And they're like, are you sure? Okay, that's a repeat question, but it's a shitty one. We're rephrasing these questions. Repeat questions like when I exampled the family tree and you talked about, you know, mom's brother who's also your uncle, and then whether or not we call him brother or uncle in the question, and then whether or not we work the family tree going from you up to your mom over to them or from that person, your mom, down to you. We're asking the same question. We're just asking a different way. That's one way to do a repeat question. Another way to do a repeat question is base it off their answers. So let's say we're looking at mom's brother and their uncle, and we're verifying a family tree, and then they refer that as Uncle Timmy. We can now call him Tim, Timothy, or Uncle Timmy at another time. In a different situation, using a repeat question where we're trying to verify, meaning this, I could use a repeat question almost the exact same style, we'll call it, where I'm trying to verify that Timmy is, in fact, uncle, brother of mom. What I can also do is ask a completely unrelated question, but I can, where it had to do with, say, this said uncle, and reference that as Timmy or mom's brother, whatever, to see how they respond to that. Whereas it doesn't sound like I'm asking a repeat question because I'm asking about some situation over here. But what I'm really, the question I'm really trying to ask is it in fact Uncle Timmy, mom's brother? And then based on how they ask to answer that, we can gauge some consistency on it. Eventually, some people will catch on this and see what you're doing and they'll kind of laugh it off. But it's a good way to get around prepared stories. And it's very helpful, especially when you have an observer that can look for deception. But if you're not very good at deception, or at least while having the conversation, you'll be looking for deception based on the answers they're giving to the questions you're answering or asking, which is how these systems of repeat and control questions work. So to get into a little bit more explanation. So while these repeat questions are asked multiple times, not just a couple, like a lot, and can be done on more than one session or conversation you're having with them at a different time, their primary purpose is to check for consistency in the answer of the person responding to them. If they're providing that answer consistency on a regular basis, it adds to the credibility of the information that they're providing you, whether or not you want to believe it. This is important too, because if they really believe something, I've talked about people, they really believe things to be true, And they don't show signs of deception, but we know it's incorrect, so they're not lying. But the other thing, too, to remember in this situation we're looking at is, let's say you started off with a control question or added a control question in here at a different time. They bring this thing up, we'll say, about Uncle Timmy again. It challenges what you know, because you know this to be true, and they're telling you, you're wrong. Okay, you can ignore it, but you shouldn't. You should explore that a little bit. Do a little follow-up. Do some repeat questions on it. And this can help narrow down the consistency of their answers when all of a sudden you find out, well, I have this over here that I knew to be true, but they're being very genuine, lack deception, being consistent in their answers that challenges this information. We can then further go on and do several things. Not all can be done at that time, but they can all be done and should all be done, like exploring a little more, finding out why they believe this to be true. How are they the person to be true? So if all these people in the world told us Uncle Timmy is a good guy, he's not the bad guy, and then this guy is actually his nephew and says, no, Uncle Timmy's the bad guy. Okay, that's a challenge worth looking at. The other things is you can go back on this all this known information and figure out where it came from, when was it submitted, how old it is, who gave you that, what are those sources vetted at, what are they rated at, what is their information consistent with, to see if maybe your information needs to be updated and changed. So what we're doing here, before we go on, is this is a way that we're evaluating and vetting the source and the information at the same time. What we're doing is trying to establish patterns of consistency over time with these sources that we very likely will meet more than once if their information's good. A lot of them come in and have bullshit, or they just want to get paid for saying the obvious, which I'm sure if you work in this world, this is something you have seen. So while we're vetting them, we're also vetting the information. We're also vetting information we already have, especially if we believe it to be true, we believe it to be correct and accurate. You know, control questions are about things we know that we know. If you're truly using qualified, vetted information, things you know that you know, the system knows, the community knows to be true, and then they challenge it, you've got probably somebody who's full of it, but it has to be explored a little bit to make sure that it's not updated new information. But control questions should only be the really good stuff you know for sure, not the suspected information, things you think you know to be true. Okay, we're going to use a vetted, qualified source at a later time that we think has knowledge or information on that to kind of qualify it to determine its value. But we're using control questions only on the things we know that we know. And whether or not we're using those, we're constantly challenging with these repeat questions so we can evaluate the source and the source's information simultaneously. We can then individually, separately, go into the information itself as well as the source itself. The other thing, too, is this doesn't have to be about the story he's telling you. You can explain to them, based on the situation you're in, that the information you give me, even if it's 100% good, is only half the story. The other half the story is where I'm getting the information from. So if you're working in, say, law enforcement, it's like, look, let's say we know for sure everything you're saying is good. That's great, but you're not a credible witness, and here's why. In the intel world, I only need you to be credible for that piece of information. I don't give a shit if you're a dirt farmer, a terrorist, or who you are. I need to know why you know it to be true to see if I can qualify that and then verify the info later. Over time, I'll evaluate you to see what level of information you're worth giving me consistently and what stuff I can dismiss. Works different on the law enforcement side. Doesn't matter what information you're giving me, I need you to be credible for that information, and there's going to be things done, background checks or whatever. So if you get a guy with a background that's criminal and bad and all these certain things that are just layered upon layered upon layered that don't apply, meaning, oh, he's this really bad guy with these 10 years of criminal history and he's telling us where all the bad stuff's happened. Good, that's qualified. That makes sense. But if there's other situations where he becomes uncredible because of the things he's done in his past. And so that's what you have to compare depending on the situation you're in to evaluate their credibility for this information. But that being said, these techniques will work on either side. It's just using them to the advantage you need to. But the point I'm also making is that we can skip or gloss over or put on standby the story they want to tell us. We can talk about them as an individual. Because if you're working in the intel side, you have to anyway. Part of getting to know them, because I'm making this vague, so if you don't understand, I'm sorry. It's just there's sources and methods stuff we don't want to talk about. But on the intel side, when you're talking to this person, there's information we're getting about them that we use, and you know what I'm saying, that helps build up a background on them that is probably going along the ideas of what you're talking about, your normal stuff. But in there, you can use the repeat and quote control questions too to validate the information about them personally that's aside from the story they're trying to tell you that's the good stuff you're trying to collect. And here's the thing. Nobody says you can only do it once. You can do that as many times as you want. You can set meetings with them just to do that. You can do that information later on. You can do that every meeting and verify something. You can start a conversation, or as you're building rapport, bring up something from that personal data you have on them and just innocuously use it incorrectly to see if they catch it and correct you because they know you got a lot of people and you say the name wrong, or you say something wrong discussing about whatever, like how was your weekend? You know, you're building rapport that way, and they tell you what you did with your kids, and you mention one of the kids' names wrong, or you get their ages wrong, or you get their genders wrong. Things like that will likely be corrected. And if they're not, then you can start to bring into question some of this personal information, which we are now then vetting our source and determining how much of that stuff is true or not. That being said, do not fall into the bias mistakes of going, oh, he's lying to me about his family, therefore his information must not be any good. No, he might be a very private person. These are separate issues. Oh, he's definitely on point and being solid about stuff about his family. So whatever he tells me today, I'm just going to subconsciously take as the gospel. No, don't do that either. That makes it easier to lie to you. Now, since we got off on a slight tangent there, let's go back to finishing discussing repeat questions. I hope this isn't boring for you, by the way. Maybe you learned something that's useful. You can have fun with your friends with this. So looking at the key aspects of the repeat question, looking for consistency. The consistency, of course, is going to verify reliability of the information, but also verifies credibility of that source. And we're looking for consistency in responses over time, although some things can be observed and determined at, say, one said meeting or one long multi-hour session. It's usually over time, and in those times actually help having days or weeks in between to meet people and discuss things to see. So many other things happen in their life that what inconsistencies are there, and are those inconsistencies generally accepted, realistic, or are they things in their storytelling or whatever that are going to indicate lying? So there are always little nuances, things that change in stories over time. That is natural. When stories are exactly the same, like exactly the same for even years, decades, they're almost always told that way because it's the best way they can tell them. And they're very deceptive and lying. And when challenged, they get angry and upset and try to go back to the original story they tell. I'll give you an example. I don't say the names because I don't want to piss anybody off. I don't want to start a conversation. But one of the most popular things in this world anymore is the UFO discussions. The funny thing about it is, if you were to ask me who the two top names were associated with this, you may not get the same names as me, but if I told you the two names I'd pick, you'd go, oh yeah, they're definitely right there. And they are the most deceptive people. The most entertaining, but the most deceptive when it comes to these stories, because their stories do not fluctuate or change for decades. And on top of that, clear sign of, hey, we need to check this out, they like just exude deception verbally, non-verbally in all of their discussions. So this is part of the reason why we want the time thing. There's going to be some changes, but we're looking for the important things that matter. Are those things changing? This is also a memory test. Part of the repeat questions now, today, and then in the future are a memory test based on the stuff they're telling us, which checks the credibility and to determine whether or not the differences in memory are normal or are they screw-ups because of a planned, prepared story. So the repetition of these questions, especially when they're unexpected, they do apply psychological pressure on this individual, and that can reveal more information or consistencies. You typically do not want to use them to apply pressure. That's a mistake. You want to allow people to screw up when you're discussing this. You don't want to apply pressure to prove that they're wrong or to verify because you think they're wrong. Be nice. Flies with honey. Even if that fly is a liar, let it happen. Laugh about it later with your buddies. And then if they come in again, you can tell them why you knew they were lying. But you don't want to challenge them at that moment if you don't have to, especially when they're volunteer. That's something you might do with a detainee, but you don't want to do that as a volunteer. You don't want to piss them off. You don't want to cause confrontation. None of that benefits you in any way. So think flies with honey. Now, control questions, on the other hand, are designed to establish a baseline of behavior and responses They can be done for that. They're also done using questions I know to be true. So, for example, if I know this information to be correct and I have some gauge of consistency, credibility on your, maybe I don't have any yet, I've just met you, I can use control questions to establish baseline behavior in things like IXS cueing, which, as a reminder, is only one of many nonverbal techniques and is not used to detect deception or lying unless it's used in conjunction with many other things that may or may not indicate that. Our primary purpose in that is to understand thought processes and patterns, how we're processing information. You know, when you're using repeat and even control questions, and let's say you understand IXS cueing and they're using visual construction, and they're using visual construction and visual remembering a lot, we know basically they use a lot of memory stuff. Just because you're using construction doesn't make it a lie. People put that on like little TikTok reels and YouTube all the time. These are people you shouldn't be listening to. I have no idea what they're talking about. All kinds of things are going to be popping in and out of visual construction just because of things with memory that are normal over time that have no indication or support of deception. But we can use those if we understand them, but you don't need to. These questions that we're using for control questions too can be similar, especially when you're looking for baseline behavior, but even when you're just trying to establish a credibility of the individual, maybe if it's, especially when it's not something you have direct knowledge of, the data they're trying to provide you about the bomb, you don't have information on this. But the control questions you can use are going to be things that you know that can be unrelated. They don't necessarily have to be related. Depends on what you're doing in the process at the time, because your entire questioning process to them is always about you getting information. They should always be leaving thinking you're trying to get information, especially if they think you're trying to get information or not, because you're really good at elicitation, right? We have that, but it's elicitation too is part of this because they're there voluntarily. But also part of your questioning might be why they're thinking you're trying to get information about, you know, bad things. They don't realize you're trying to get information on them through a virtue of repeat and control questions and to establish baseline behavior and to figure out their credibility. So we're gaining, what we're doing is gaining knowledge on their normal response patterns and compare them against more critical or sensitive questions. That's part of what control questions can do. Control questions can also be a lot softer. Repeat questions are about validating and verifying information they provided. Control questions can be soft questions. They don't have to be hard information. These can just be normal rapport building stuff. It's a great time to use that to gauge stuff we've already been told. You can work repeat questions in there in a soft form using control questions to figure out where we're at with this information. These are very effective in rapport building. And remember that rapport building, especially if you're on this job, you know, rapport building isn't like it is in training where it's like, okay, you've done 5 minutes, buzzer, they're broken. You're always building rapport. You always have to go back to it. You can screw up with one question, not even know why, and rapport is dead and you've got to stop everything you're doing to reestablish it. And repeating control questions can be a part of that. They don't need to be every time. It doesn't need to be both, but they can work very well. The key aspects of control question is a baseline establishment. So we're looking for those normal patterns, including verbals and nonverbals. This can be used as a truthfulness gauge or accuracy gauge, we'll say. So objective truthfulness, but accuracy based on questions they're likely to answer truthfully. So let's say there's things you know, right? Things we know. We're asking them things we know because we have a reasonable expectation that they should know the answer. Because some guy comes in a dirt farmer, we're not going to ask him about nuclear fission. Obviously, those things don't click. So we're going to make sure that these questions, these things we know, are things they would reasonably know or understand about or have comprehension of. This is why I say control questions quite often don't have to be on topic. They can be completely off topic and be used in rapport building. So you can go back, they're getting a little frustrated, maybe they don't want to talk about bad guy anymore, but you can go back to talking about their job as a welder and you're building rapport, right? And that might be secondary. You may not have a need for rapport, but maybe that's secondary to the fact that while that's the biggest benefit you're getting, you're using control questions to get them more comfortable again, and you're using it to gauge physical responses you're seeing, and you're realizing that, yes, they were really upset before, so now this time I'm going to go back into it again, and maybe I'm going to purposely kind of make them upset again, go down this path, but I'm going to watch for things I wasn't looking for before. I'm going to watch for eye movements, or I'm going to watch for their physical posture. I'm going to watch, are they showing open displays of body language? Are they showing closed displays? Are they anchoring somewhere? Are they doing self-soothing things? You know, where, what are they really focused on? What gets them excited? Are they leaning forward? All the basic stuff. You're going to maybe repeat the situation that caused the problem, as long as it wasn't an explosive problem. Do it kind of mildly while observing a little more to see what they're going into, and then determine, what is it really? Is this a thing they don't know anything about, or is it just an uncomfortable conversation? Is there something they're hiding? We always think it's something they're hiding, but actually a lot of times it's not the case at all. So it might be a deceptive indicator when we use control questions, where they have deviations from their baseline. So control questions is one way, but not the only way, to identify some baseline behaviors. And however we've done that, we can still use them to look for deviations. But then when we see deviations from the baseline, remember, deviation from baseline doesn't mean it's deception. It just means it's different. We have to determine why it's different. So that's why I said, when we talked about baselines a couple years ago, I used Thanksgiving, where I was like, we go to the market every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and we do that because that's our pattern, that's our habit, and we have expectations, the baseline of how it's going to be, and that's how it always. But then one day a year, you have to go Wednesday at 10 a.m. because you forgot something. You forgot the rubbed sage. And then it's the day before Thanksgiving. Guess what? Baseline's changed. It's the baseline, though, for that day. That day just happens once a year, right? So it's to say that even if you see a deviation baseline, that doesn't necessarily challenge credibility, truthfulness, and accuracy. What that challenges is you to determine why is the deviation there. Sometimes it's just people uncomfortable. Doesn't always mean they're hiding things. So repeat questions, that's how we check consistency and reliability and memory. Control questions, we can establish baselines, we can check baselines with them, we can check truthfulness or accuracy, and we can use them as deception indicators. This helps us discern reliability of the information. These are techniques that the reason I think these are important is because back when I was training guys here in Fort Huachuca, I was astonished at how downhill that school had gone. They are terribly trained now. Like, I wanted to punch people in the face when I went to that school, right? Like, I switched over to that job. I was a senior NCO when I went through the training. Like, got selected and promoted while I was there. So I went from a staff sergeant to a sergeant first class while I was there. I was very patient. I was very smart. I was like one of the senior guys. I was really good at this, some of the stuff, some of it I had time with, but I understand how military schools work. I knew the game. I was accepting of many, many things in a very patient man, and I wanted to punch fuckers in the face because they wouldn't shut up about follow-up questioning, as important as it is. And they would teach us techniques and stuff, but I'm like, bro, I get it. It was only a few years later, I'm training these guys right before the program shut down. They come out there like, yeah, they talk about it a little bit. Like, they didn't, I was just like, it's like they just said, fuck it, we're not going to teach this. We're not going to teach a necessary skill anymore. Right? They took so much of that out. It's like saying, oh, you're an infantryman? Yeah. So, oh, you qualified on the range of basic training? Good. We're not going to shoot bullets again unless there's a war. So you'll never see a rifle or clean it for the next 10 years. Like, that's that's about the equivalent of what they were doing. I think that's a fair thing to say. So it's a perishable skill, but it's so horrible. So if you are one of these guys, you're one of these humans guys, very likely that depending on where you're at, that the training's changed and you're not getting what was available 10, 15 years ago. So that's why these are so important. And this comes into the plan, the questioning plan of how we're going to get this information. At the lower levels on the intel side, the questioning plan is really focused heavily and trained when it comes into the interrogation, which you're not discussing. You're just talking about walk-ins, right? But the thing is, if you went through that, and if you did it in the Army, didn't have much training on that either. The questioning plan can be used. You can have generic, basic questioning plans as an outline to follow to make sure you don't lose track just for anybody that comes in. But you've talked to this guy, he's a walk-in, and let's say he's given you said information. So you've gone back and checked it, and you're going to come back, you're going to do some repeating control questions, you're trying to get some more information about whatever. You could have a built questioning plan for this guy. It's not an interrogation for you to have a questioning plan. It's not illegal, you don't have to run approaches. You can have a plan to follow, and the best thing about it is you don't have to do it. If you did do it in training, you don't have to do it in training where you go step by step by step by step by step. You can bounce around and flow with the conversation, just like you might go 1 through 10 on questions, but you may not do them immediately. You might go one and two, and then you build rapport or to discuss ice cream or whatever, and you come back and you do three, and then you bounce over here and you do this. The other thing is you can do one and two and then go talk about building rapport, and then you can come back and do 7B or 7B12 or something and bounce around like that. If you have the question planner, can track the information, it's like a timeline, right? We hope we ask the timeline between 07 and 1900 that they give it to us minute by minute in correct order, but they're going to bounce around in their memory, which is somewhat normal. I'd almost be concerned of a lengthy timeline knowing an order unless it was like, you know, like a big history thing. Well, Columbus discovered America then, and then here's Plymouth Rock, and then here's when we became a country. Like something big spaced out like that, that makes sense. But the timelines that you're typically used to seeing following those events, you know, if it's real tight what happened on this night when you left the party, maybe they nail that down. But a lot of the stuff that we're looking at in this field, assuming you're doing the same job I did, is going to be over a period of days sometimes, or weeks and hours, and then a lot of things happen, and especially if there's a lot of things in their life and they live in a city and they went to school and they do all this, and we want more details, and a lot of times they bounce around or they go, oh, and I, you know what, this person was there too when I talked to them, because they don't remember that at the time. That's very realistic and not a sign of deception. Because that's normal to conversation, with practice, okay, because it's going to feel awkward when you haven't done it, and then even then it takes a while to be smooth. With practice, you can just force that through questioning to be completely erratic in your questioning plan, which would piss people off. But if you can pull it off, which initially you're pulling it off until you smooth it out, it's a more natural conversation. So you have to think about, what's a natural conversation to Bob over here that I'm talking about? Is he a logical, linear person, or is he a more emotional, erratic person? How are they presenting information to me? You can mirror their behaviors and attitudes, but you can match their conversation and say, this is how they talk, man. So this is how I'm going to do it. You can practice it and have your question plan like that and bounce all over. And here's the thing. Let's say you got a question plan. You got five main groups you want to follow. In each main group, you have 10 questions. Each 10 questions, you have five logical follow-ups. Each one of them, you have five logical follow-ups. That's like hundreds of questions. You're not going to get through them all, you know. And there's no reason to say he's necessarily going to know them all or be able to recall them accurately, and things won't change. But it's a way to get more information more efficiently in that shorter amount of time, because a lot of time in these walk-ins, like I said, we have time constraints. And even when we don't have time constraints, sometimes guys just want, it's like they want a friend. Like they just want to freaking talk, and you're like, bro, I got shit to do. So we make it more efficient, but you don't ever want to make them feel rushed. You don't ever want to make them feel unimportant. You don't ever want to make them think that you don't care. You want them to believe you're their best friend. Yeah, that's going to bring them back, but it helps with the rapport side. And then all you have to do is manage that asset and determine when you need to cut them off. Basically, when you need to cut ties and say, no more, we're ending this relationship. You know, that might happen. Or giving them guidelines or boundaries and saying, you only come here when you have this. Don't come here with this stuff anymore. I've got it. You have to control that asset on your own. But the vetting process of the information and the person, because you probably don't have a lot of these other things still, even if you had it, you have to do it at the source. And a big portion of it is planning the conversation out through repeat and control questions and being able to do it on the fly to check the information, check the source, and hear what they're saying and determine whether or not it's got enough value for you. And then having the patience to send them away. And then when they come back later, you've done a little bit of your own research where you can. You've had a plan built. You do some more repeat and control questions. And you basically, in the questioning side of it, because we're not doing approaches, in the questioning side of it, you might treat it like a long interrogation. Like if you're in there for 6 or 8 hours, it just might be a period of 1 hour a week for 6 weeks until you get there, depending on what your situation is, which you have to determine on your own. So hopefully this helps you. If you have any more questions, let me know. If you don't understand that, let me know. If you're looking for other techniques, let me know. Thanks for the email. Glad you love the show. Sounds like you're actually doing this job. Please get back to me if you are and tell me what you can about what you're doing and if you have any more questions that I can help you with. And for anybody else, I hope you enjoyed the show. Learn about repeat and control questions. And I know what many of you are thinking. I'm going to fuck with my kids next time they're in trouble. I absolutely encourage you to do that because it's fun. Separate them into different rooms, treat it like an interrogation, repeat and control questions. Oh, it'll get to the, you want to do it when they're young, to the point where they almost do it for fun, so that by the time they get into the past preteen and the teen years, they're like, yeah, I just don't lie anymore, because they're always going to know. That's it's the dream of every parent, isn't it?